Mackenzie Eaglin's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and she is writing in U.S. News and World Report under the headline, Stop Asking the Military to Do More with Less. Mackenzie, I thought we finally were getting out of the trap in the federal government to ask agencies to do more with less. I thought we'd convinced enough people that that's not feasible. You obviously don't see that happening vis-a-vis the Pentagon, Mackenzie.
No, it's not even that I don't see it. It's actually what is happening. So if you listen to the, you know, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps leadership, they are pounding the table over and over telling Congress and anyone who will listen that this is what's happening, and it just isn't sinking in for whatever reason. Let's just go back to 2013, you know, just a short year ago. Of course, in budget terms, that was the year that sequestration, the automatic spending cuts as part of the failed debt ceiling deal, took effect for the U.S. military. And it was a pretty big tab, and it came on top of those other defense cuts that had already been underway. Last year, when the first year of sequestration took effect, the demands on the military actually went up. Everybody's sitting around thinking, but hey, you know, we're out of Iraq. Afghanistan is, you know, we're at roughly 40,000 U.S. forces counted and drawing down very rapidly to 10, possibly 5 or maybe even 5,000 or fewer. You know, so that means we can just sort of come back, reset, take time off, retrain, you know, et cetera. And that's not what's happening. There's all this pent up demand from combatant commanders, and the military is just as active, if not more, today than it's ever been.
And we see the possibility of that activity continuing to increase as we look at what's going on in Eastern Europe. And we see some of the aggression, albeit kind of under the table, that China's undertaking. I mean, the threats that we've faced historically don't seem to indicate that they're going to become less over the foreseeable future.
That's right. If there's one thing President Putin has done, it's remind everyone that those 19th century problems, they really do still, they can still rear their head and become, you know, real challenges even today. You know, but it's interesting with the president on his trip to Asia this week, you know, and we're all familiar with, you know, his long-term goal to rebalance and pivot to Asia, and for the Defense Department included, among other federal priorities. But yet, really, the Defense Department's been pivoting to Africa for the last several years, for all intents and purposes, and of course trying to keep a lid on the tinderbox simmering in the Middle East. And, you know, so there has been not a moment to lose to take, for the military to take their eye off the ball anywhere. But yet, you know, in 2012, you know, they were told the tide of war was receding. They were told that the pivot is real, that, you know, South America and Africa could, and even Europe as a producer of security, you know, we're going to become these sort of lesser focused areas for U.S. military presence, exercises, capabilities, et cetera. And what everyone's learning and finding out painfully, I would argue, is that the world and what we do in it and where we do it is not a zero-sum game or outcome. And you can't focus on one region at the expense of other, and at least not when you're a global power with global reach, interests, and responsibilities.
You quote the Vice Chief of Staff of the Army telling Congress something similar to what he told me on this program not too long ago. We're mortgaging the future as far as cuts today in order to save money to try to get back on a more responsible fiscal track, Mackenzie. And you detail in this piece in U.S. News and World Report the history of how we got to where we are today. But I want to call your attention to this passage from your piece. The Pentagon's latest strategy continues moving the goalposts by calling for a force-size construct designed to defeat one enemy while denying the objectives or imposing unacceptable costs on a second. When I hear the term moving the goalposts normally, the implication there is that there is something negative going on. Is that how you see this?
That's absolutely how I see this, and I'm not picking on anyone. This is a trend that's been underway since the end of the Cold War, since the bottom-up review in 1993 with presidents of both political parties, you know, that we've been over time very slowly sort of unwinding, unpacking, and watering down the classic two-war standard for America's military, you know, and it's not even necessarily that, you know, we expect that to be the outcome, just that we are capable of that, should it be required, you know, at the same time. And no one can argue that our military would never be called upon to do 2, 3, 4, even 5 things at the same time. You know, depending on, you know, the type of activity, of course. Not everything is conflict and a hot war. So it's just a remarkable place. You know, this started actually in 2010, where Secretary Gates under President Obama started walking away by his own words from this two-war standard. And it, and again, this latest Pentagon strategy takes us even further towards doing that. We're basically moving to, you know, the ability to fight one big short war and punish, you know, for the second one until we can get over there and deal with that problem if it's still going on when the big short war is over. And that's just incredibly unrealistic, again, for a superpower. And what concerns me the most is, you know, I don't like the tail wagging the dog, and that's really what I see happening here, which is, you know, this starving of, you know, military strength and power and capability in the hopes that American foreign policy will be restricted and constrained and that we will ultimately end up doing less around the world. That's okay if we were upfront about it and had that conversation directly with the American people, but I don't think anyone actually signed up for that explicitly, but that's actually what's happening. So, you know, the capacity and the capability reductions in the military that are underway now, you know, just listening to the chiefs, this is not something that's going to be a problem in 5 years. It's happening now. That's already influencing our enemies. It's worrying our friends and allies. Are you really going to be there like you said you would X years ago if XYZ happens? And we're seeing that the ultimate consequence of this capability and capacity reduction is that there are fewer options for the commander-in-chief. When he says, what can we do about this problem here and that problem there? And as you know, they are only growing in number and complexity. And that's the real worry.
Mackenzie Eaglin's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, writing in U.S. News and World Report. You write, the worry is that the U.S. military's strategic aims are shrinking along with global presence and combat capabilities, but policymakers aren't correspondingly reducing the military scope of responsibilities in support of national vital interests. That, in my mind, when I read between the lines there, Mackenzie, it sounds like you're getting at the core of the discussion that you and I and other military experts I've talked to have expressed, and that is, what's the connection between how much money we have to spend and how we're going to spend it and the mission we expect people to fulfill with that amount of money?
Unfortunately, you know, we're not even bothering to ask the question anymore, the proverbial we, the political class, so to speak, you know, because this is just a budget-driven, you know, discussion. Here's the number. Now figure out what you guys can do with that, you know, what kind of force you can build and buy and maintain. And, of course, there's that great gaping hole and disconnect between then, of course, what the nation, broadly speaking, is asking the military to do. So it's just a budget number. It's handed down from on high, like the tablets, and out comes a smaller, less capable military. But yet, policymakers, again, there's no reduction in appetite. This is what we would call a supply and demand problem if we were really smart economists. And it seems so simple and straightforward. But unfortunately, it's not just money that's going to be required to address it. It's time. And that's the thing that is a consequence that will be borne uniquely by those in uniform if and when they're called to go support the next mission somewhere, whatever that might be, whether that's war prevention or war fighting. And time is the asset here most at risk, and it means that you pay more in money and in blood and treasure if that's what you've sacrificed to get to that point.
Congress typically responds, Mackenzie, to catastrophic events or events that make such an impression and a public relations situation that they can't be ignored. I wonder if the news that we're learning about this afternoon might be one of those cases. Sky News in Great Britain's reporting two Russian bombers flew close to UK airspace, chased away by a Royal Air Force jet fighter. This is a sign of an aggressive country that is not friendly to the interests of the United States or NATO, and the countries contained in NATO. And I wonder if there are a sufficient number of these events happening, given some of the aggression we're seeing from China, that members of Congress might finally say, wait a minute, maybe we have been constricting our military in ways we don't want, and we need to relook at things.
I hope that's true, because, you know, this really is a a gradual eye-opening process for members. I don't know that there will be just one event, but I think you are right in that slowly over time, and this may be the tipping point, just even not just the bomber fly, but the annexation of Crimea, you know, and coming on top of so many other problems from Syria to North Korea to Egypt to Turkey to Iran, and the list is quite long to North Africa and the Horn of Africa. I mean, it's just very, very long. And our foreign policy seems to increasingly be one of managing crises, no longer actively solving problems. And that's what we, you know, in the past have used and had our military support that. And slowly over time, I think that there is an awakening here in Washington that we may have thought we could come home and re-garrison and hunker down and focus on the nation building at home and et cetera. But what policymakers are slowly learning is that the rest of the world doesn't stand still when we do that. And when we do leave a vacuum behind, it doesn't go unfilled. There are certainly many other people ready to jump in and shape events and lead them or change them or alter the course of history, whether we want them to or not, which is exactly the case for continued American leadership. And this may be right about the time I think you see bipartisanship on this need to do more, that maybe we pulled back just a tad too far.